Hello, listeners. Welcome to the show. I'm Matt Gourley. What show? This show. I Was There Too. The podcast where I talk to people present in the great scenes of cinema history, and today, a holy grail guest. Kevin Page from RoboCop. The guy in the boardroom that gets just obliterated and eviscerated by Ed 209, and, according to my research, seems to be, perhaps, the most squibbed man in film history? I don't know, if you're a regular listener to this podcast, you know that I went on a great journey, really a vision quest, to find a way to personally get squibbed, you know, shot with movie blood packs like they do in the movies when someone gets machine gunned. And on the 50th episode of this podcast, I was able to have that dream fulfilled. But a guest that I wanted to talk to for that very podcast was actually Kevin Page, just because his squib scene is so memorable, because it's so gratuitous. And I thought, who better to talk to than the man with more cinema holes in him than Sonny Corleone from The Godfather, even? And during this interview, we even discuss the numbers of squibs. And though it doesn't seem like there's any final hard count on either circumstance, it seems pretty clear that Kevin has been squibbed the most. This is a banner day. So there's nothing else to say except let's get to it. If you like this show and you're a regular listener, please give it a 5-star review on iTunes. It helps with the visibility. And you can follow me on Twitter at Matt Gourley, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Or if you're into other films, check out James Bonding, which is now back every week, the show that I do with Matt Myra, where we discuss every James Bond film and do special episodes in between. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Umar Ditta for making this interview happen. And now let's do this. The film, RoboCop. The year, 1987. The role, Mr. Kinney. The actor, Kevin Page. So Kevin, when you first read the script after having gotten the part of Mr. Kinney in RoboCop and saw the death scene on the page, what did you imagine it looking like versus what it turned out to be, which is basically you turning into a blood sprinkler?
Well, first off, that's 30 years ago, so it's perhaps a little foggy in my memory, but it seems to me that, and this is possibly not true, but just when you asked the question, I have a vague memory of actually including that sort of being shot in the audition for Verhoeven. I believe that as part of the audition process, I took the scene all the way up through, you know, sort of the reaction of being shot. And, you know, the way that scene was filmed, it took place over, I think it was a total of about 6 days worth of shooting, but it was spread out over a couple of months. And the story that I sometimes tell about this is I got cast for that show, that movie, in the summer between my first and second year of graduate school in the MFA acting program at SMU, which at the time was a very renowned conservatory, and very lucky, one of the top young students in the country to have been accepted into this program, and I completed a year of training as a stage actor, Shakespeare and the like, and during the summer, I went out and I got an agent and was trying to, you know, book some commercials and get a little bit of experience. And that was when I got the audition call for RoboCop, and I went and did the audition. And as I recall, there was a couple or three different callback sequences. It took a while, and it was supposed to shoot during the summer when I was on break from school. Well, they kept pushing the shooting schedule of that scene until it got into the month of August and became essentially a conflict with grad school. And so I called my advisor at SMU's theater department. I said, look, I got cast in this little movie. I may need to take a day, possibly even 2 days off from classes in order to shoot this film. And I wanted to see if I could get permission to do so because it was fairly strict, you know, strict program. Uh-huh. And the woman basically said, well, no. At some point, you must learn to choose between the theater and this movie thing. And so I like to tell people that I ended up getting my MFA from RoboCop instead of SMU because I had to make a hard choice. And so, frankly, I think that was probably one of the better professional decisions I've ever made, because I certainly have appreciated having that credit on my resume for the last 30 years. Anyway, the point is we shot the scene leading up to the whole shootout thing over a period of about 3 days on location in a office tower in downtown Dallas on the 54th floor. And it culminated in me getting splattered, you know, onto the table, et cetera. But it wasn't bloody enough for Verhoeven, and this is pretty well documented in other places. So he called me back 2 months later, and they rebuilt the entire boardroom set inside soundstage number one at the studios of Las Colinas, which was a, you know, 10,000 square foot or something like that soundstage at the time. And they rebuilt the entire room, the model of Delta City, which I crash into. And then they had a cyclorama that had sort of the same background view as the actual building downtown Dallas had. And we reshot me being shot for 3 days.
Oh, my God.
And so, to answer your original question, I highly doubt that I would have understood from reading the script what was actually going to be involved in that. But then again, this was also really my first speaking role in a film, particularly in an action film, and I ended up doing several more, I think probably more as a result of having been in RoboCop than anything else. Uh-huh. And so, you know, a lot of the experience to me was sort of a first-time thing. Anyway, so, you know, I was a young actor. I was kind of an intense actor. I was a serious actor. As I said, I'd been trained to do Shakespeare and the like. And so I just tried to take as seriously and earnestly everything that, you know, I was asked to do and do a good job, which is kind of how actors think.
God, this leads me down a whole road of questions that I have. I hope I remember them all, because I had a friend in grad school that had a similar thing happen where she was offered a role in Jim Carrey's Liar Liar, but was locked into this grad school MFA play and chose the play. And I think to this day she regrets it. So if that's some consolation to you, I hope so. But so did you not go back to grad school at all? Did you quit from that point on, or did you, were they?
I did have to resign. I had a full scholarship to that particular program, and I was forced essentially to resign. So I simply picked up and had my, you know, began my professional career both on the stage. I got my equity card shortly thereafter that, which is the Stage Actors Union, and I got my SAG card as a result of doing RoboCop. So within a couple of I think it was over that summer, I performed at the Dallas Shakespeare Festival while I was sort of in between the shoots for the movie. Shortly after that, I got cast on the TV show Dallas.
Yeah.
And played a very small part as a waiter on Dallas.
But a very significant part later on, right?
Yeah, it turns out, in the history of things, it turns out I actually appeared in small parts on Dallas probably 3 times during the original show. And then, I guess, since you queued it up so nicely, many, many years later, they brought Dallas back onto cable TV while Larry Hagman was still alive. And so I was still living in Dallas as a professional actor, and I was actually cast to play J.R. Ewing's henchman, character named Bum. And in the middle of, you know, they'd always have me out spying on people and digging up dirt and sort of doing the nasty things that J.R. Ewing always did. as a character. And, you know, Larry Hagman, of course, was a lovely man and a wonderful actor to work with and a great mentor. But in the middle of the second season, as we were shooting away, Larry Hagman actually died from cancer. He'd had some cancer, and he succumbed to that literally in the middle of the season. So they took about a month off over Christmas, basically, because he died over the Thanksgiving break. And when they came back, they had done some rewriting and had to sort of figure out a way to deal with J.R.'s character being gone. And they were very, very secretive, the producers were. And so we're shooting along, and they call me. There's a lot of mystery about the script, but they call me in to do a pickup shot in a phone conversation. They actually kept all of the footage of Larry Hagman before he had passed away, and they figured out a way to kind of cobble it together, and they didn't tell me anything about this, but I get called in to do this shot, and the director says, "Have they told you anything about what happens to your character?" And I said, "No, not really." And he said, "Well, come here, come into your dressing room and close the door." And there he proceeded to explain to me that my character actually was the one that was going to shoot and kill J.R. Ewing in the end, but it was a big secret, and it couldn't be revealed until almost a year later when the actual episode aired on TV. So I started as a humble waiter on Dallas as my first TV gig, and 30 years or 25 so or so years later, I ended up being, I had now the Jeopardy question that asked who killed J.R. Ewing, and the answer is Kevin Page.
So, oh my God.
That's my Dallas TV show story.
That's fantastic. That's funny. This podcast you're on right now, just 2 weeks ago, was a Jeopardy answer as well. So I feel like some kindred brotherhood. I know. So you mentioned that RoboCop was your first speaking role. What was it like to walk into such a huge blockbuster, especially one directed by Verhoeven, who's known to be pretty intense, right? But you said yourself you were pretty intense. So was it like Mines, or was it scary?
It was awesome. Are you kidding? Oh, here was this Dutch guy that, you know, when they when Ed 209 was supposed to walk in the room, they actually had a full-scale model of Ed 209, about 8 feet tall. And it was the, you know, when you see the shots of the robot, of Ed 209 standing in that boardroom, it was actually there. They just didn't have him. They green-screened him for when they did the stop-action, you know, animation. And so there was a, for instance, a reaction shot where first the Ed 209 first comes clumping into the room and kind of growls, and everybody at the board table, you know, freaks out and kind of jumps back. Well, that was filmed by Verhoeven standing in front of this full scale model and screaming at the top of his lungs, roaring at the actors and raising his hands up like claws, and literally acting out the part of Ed 209 to give us something to react to. So I don't think, I can't imagine how a first film speaking role film experience could be any better.
That's tremendous. I want to talk about you getting squibbed, because anybody that's listened to this show before knows that it's been a lifelong dream of mine to get squibbed like they get in the movies. And so this show enabled that to happen, where a special effects house hooked me up and shot me 5 times. And it was a dream come true. But you were always a holy grail guest for me on this show, because as far as I can tell, you are the most squibbed human being in all of history. Is that what you understand to be the case?
Well, I understand that that's the hyperbole around the legend that, you know, as what the Three Stooges said, it's a mockery of a sham, of a whatever. So I don't really know what the truth is. I do know that they put a whole ton of squibs on me, to the point where the special effects guys were, you know, we became quite close, because they thought it was pretty funny that they were blowing up this young kid as bad as they were. And so and Verhoeven kept shouting, "More blood, more blood." And as several of the articles that have come out recently have explained, the crew, when we were reshooting this on the soundstage at Las Colinas, the crew literally wore rain ponchos or or plastic garbage bags over their clothes because there was so much blood going everywhere. And they claim, if we're going to add to the legend, they claim that to this very day, up in the rafters where they have a whole grid system where you can walk around and move lights around on that stage number one, they claim that there are still spots of stage blood up in the rafters of that sound studio some 30 years later. So.
I would love someone working there who might listen to this, I don't know, even 10, 15 years from now, up in the catwalks, changing out a light, send a picture of some blood spatter so we can confirm this. I did a little research, and as far as I can tell, and you can never trust the internet, something close to 200 squibs on you, but the closest I can think of for someone else is James Caan in The Godfather, and all I can find is either the number 149 on James Caan, or according to the FX guy, 80. So I'm just going to say we print the legend and say you're the most squibbed person, because it certainly looks like it on screen. It's an incredible death scene, and it actually hurt a little bit, right, in a particular area, if I did my research right?
You're going to make me tell that part of the story? So the way squibs work is they're basically like firecrackers taped to a quarter or a half dollar, meaning that they fire in one direction. And so they fire out from, they kind of look like a coin, and then they fire out from that coin, and the coin is basically like a, you know, the back of the thing, and that's what they tape close to your body, inside the clothes, but they try to keep them close to your body because if the squib gets, you know, a couple of inches away from you, say it's sewn into the lining of your suit, and it gets a few inches away from you, when that shoots out one direction, it'll kick back in the other direction, and that piece of metal that's the backing of the thing will actually kind of punch you. And so the other thing you have to watch out for is when a squib goes off, it is actually about like a black cat firecracker, and it's shooting through usually a condom filled with stage blood and through the fabric of your shirt, and depending on how powerful they are, you know, it spits a little bit of fire. So if you're getting shot a lot from a lot of different squibs going off at once, and you get, for instance, your arm in front of a squib that's going off on your chest, you know, it can actually burn you. So I did receive several small burns from you know, the series of takes that we did with all the squibs. And the story I think you're going for, that apparently you're not going to let me off from.
No, I'm not.
Is the last take of the shoot. Basically, Verhoeven kept shouting, more blood, more blood. And so the FX guys were at lunch because they had a commissary at the studios at the time. And they were serving spaghetti squash. And so what these guys did was they took a big old wad of the spaghetti squash and stuffed it in a pound baggie. And they filled that baggie up with stage blood, and then they put God only knows how many squibs directly behind that. So instead of a condom, which is usually what they use, or a balloon, they literally filled a full baggie with squash, and then they put a whole bunch of charges behind it. And you can see this in the director's cut. This is one of the shots that was cut from the original film because of the X rating, but it was restored in the director's cut at like the 15-year version or some such.
And just to be clear, it was your death scene, at least partially, and Peter Weller's head getting blown off that got it that original X rating, right? Because it was so gory and prolonged.
24 times. Yeah. that's the story. As the story goes, it was the 25th time, and Verhoeven finally cut out the chunk of Weller's head flying off. And this basically this one shot where you see me laying on the table and I'm just sort of getting blown up and this big old chunk comes splurting out of the guy, poor guy, Mr. Kinney's abdomen, that was the spaghetti squash being blown up. And at the end of that particular shot, poor Mr. Kinney's dead.
Right.
And, you know, they kept rolling, so you can't, when you make a movie, you know, you got to keep doing whatever you're doing until the director calls cut. And in this case, I was lying there dead. But on that last round where they had literally, you know, I'd already been shot and laid back on the table, and then they reloaded So the sequence was really in about five different pieces. So they reloaded all this stuff into poor Kenny, laying there on the table so they could just keep shooting him. And in the last take, the very last squib to go off, hit me in the left nut.
Oh, God.
And I and Verhoeven didn't call cut for 10 seconds. And when he did, I believe I used an expletive, but I was granted, as a young actor, you know, you probably shouldn't have such an attitude, but they let me pass on that one. So,
well, that's incredible dedication that you take a squib to the left nut and can hold your tongue and lay dead for 10 seconds. You're coming fresh out of grad school. Were you using some kind of Stanislavski approach or some method or something?
I just didn't want to get shouted at by Verhoeven.
That's a scarier motivation. You actually got a stunt credit for this, right? Because of such physical work you had to do?
I did, and I still to this day think that stunt credit almost got me fired, but I didn't know any better at the time. And the way that happened was, I don't think I knew anything about what they call a stunt bump, but if you do a stunt, often stuntmen will get additional pay, it's hazard pay basically, and occasionally when an actor will do a stunt, they give you what's called a stunt bump, so they give you an extra day's pay for doing something hazardous and generally foolish, in my eyes today anyway. And I had heard about this because several people came up to me and said, oh golly, you should get a stunt bump for this. And I said, well gosh, what's a stunt bump? And they kind of told me what it was, and so I go down on the day that I'm getting shot in the skyscraper tower, and we're sitting at lunch, and I'm sitting across from some crew guy with a beard, and I'm saying, you know, we've already been shot twice that day, and I'm kind of got a lot of adrenaline going, and I'm like talking to this guy, and I don't really know who he is, and I'm like, yeah, well, I sure better get a stunt bump for this, I say, and it turns out that the crew guy was John Davison, the producer of the film.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's how I got the stunt bump was I asked the executive producer for it, not knowing that was who he was, and certainly not knowing that it was probably inappropriate for a first-time actor to say such a thing to the producer of the film. So that's the story of the stunt bump.
Do you remember...
Yeah, thanks, John!
Do you remember the atmosphere in the room between these giant squib takes, like especially the one where you're lying on the table and they're all in their blood ponchos? Was it just like people react after a fireworks show? Was it memorable at all?
Well, it was a sizable stunt, and yeah, you know, it was loud because you got 50 or 100 or whatever it was firecrackers going off at once, and there's blood flying everywhere, and you know, you kind of want to get it right because it costs a lot of money to reset all this stuff. I think they had five different versions of my suit that they had to keep, you know, blowing up in different ways. And so, you know, as I found out later, in doing a lot of other action films, doing a big stunt in an action movie's a big kind of exciting deal. It's scary. It's high risk. It's intense, because you're portraying, you know, something obviously you would prefer not to go through in real life. And when it comes off, it's very exciting, really, for everybody involved, because not only is there actual, you know, personal risk if you're doing the stunt yourself, but there's also the risk to the production that you don't get it right and you have to redo it and it costs you time, et cetera. So as I recall, everybody was pretty pleased with how that worked out. And by the time, you know, Verhoeven got enough blood to sate him, everybody was generally pretty impressed with how big we actually made that go.
I can't imagine.
Again, it was my first movie. What the hell did I know?
Right. I can't imagine the cleanup between takes. How many? You mentioned you had five suits. Do you remember how many Delta City architectural models that you land on they had standing by?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's too long ago.
That's all right.
I mean, a lot of what happened with the Delta City model, I'm sure they had more than one version of it, but a lot of that sequence, if you actually look at the film carefully, took place after he lands on the model.
Oh, right.
Because he just keeps getting shot on and on and on, and that was the over-the-top part of it. you know, you don't think about it. I just thought about this the first time the other day when I was rewatching the film, that, you know, Ed 209 is standing up across the room. Kenny is flat on his back on this model, yet there are bullet hits that are squirting blood straight up from him, which would be at a 90-degree angle to the actual gun. So physically, it doesn't actually make sense.
Right.
You know, did Ed 209 fly up to the ceiling, shoot down at him? Right? So, but it was good fun and heck of an action sequence.
That's for sure. What was it like working with Ronnie Cox and Miguel Ferrer?
You know, I learned a lot from those guys. We didn't really spend enough time to get particularly close, I wouldn't say, but those were, like, I had been an extra, for instance, in Terms of Endearment, and I'd sort of been on the set with Deborah Winger, and I'd met Jeff, it's one of my favorite actors, Jeff from Terms of Endearment, and so that had really been, you know, my primary exposure to working on a film set was as an extra. So when I came on with these guys who were, you know, all of them were really Hollywood veterans at that point. They weren't quite as well known, of course, as they became. But, you know, it was a real learning experience and a lot of fun to sort of hang out with the movie stars and kind of see what that that whole vibe was like. So I learned an awfully lot about being cool while you're sitting in a makeup chair waiting to go on. And I learned a lot about practical jokes and sarcasm and wit and things like that. So these guys were funny and clever, and as I recall, I just sort of soaked that up as best I could. And when they went on, they you know, when the cameras rolled, as an audience member, you often don't think about what it's the level of intensity that even seeming, you know, innocuous scenes actually what level they're at when they're performed. So we're walking, you know, we're doing the scene where we're walking into the boardroom and we're just having a conversation, but really the intensity and the energy of this conversation was quite high. And what you learn very quickly as an actor when you're working with other very good actors is if you don't match the energy of the people you're working with, you're very likely to get cut out of the scene. You know, they'll literally wipe you off of the screen, and they'll only do the close-ups of the stars because that's, you know, that's what's interesting. So I learned about you know, matching others' actors' energy blow for blow, and kind of standing your own, which is a principle of particularly screen acting that I've used ever since.
Did you ever hear any of the reactions of your fellow MFA students or even your teachers after this came out?
You know, most of my classmates actually stayed in that program and graduated, and several of them became professional theater actors. And while I did theater for a while, I gravitated more towards, you know, film and television, and I spent several years in Los Angeles doing, you know, TV drama, guest starring on things like In the Heat of the Night and Quantum Leap and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I'm sure they saw it, but I don't really recall a conversation about, golly, you were good or anything like that, because actors often don't do that sort of thing for some reason.
Right, right.
They're too busy being cool like Miguel and the guys in the chairs, you know.
Well, you seem like the go-to guy in Texas. How competitive is the acting scene there? And would you say it's a benefit to not be living in L.A. and having lived in L.A. in the past, or New York or something?
Well, you know, they're just different. There's traditionally, there's been, I mean, that's a whole actual world, maybe more than you want to know. But, you know, the main film and television capital of the world is Los Angeles, probably followed by New York, and then there's a number of regional markets. And back at the time we made RoboCop and that they were filming Dallas, the TV series, here on location, Dallas really represented what they called the Third Coast, which was, you know, one of the top regional markets where film companies and TV companies would go, you know, on location to create their work. But about and you know, don't check my numbers on this or anything, but about 10, 15, maybe 20 years ago, individual states around the country started offering incentives to film companies to come film on location in their state.
Right.
And Texas has gotten sort of in on this, but since the days of RoboCop, filming on location, particularly in different states, has become very competitive just to win the productions. And Texas has sadly, you know, it's got some political challenges. And so while they had a reasonable film incentive program that was kind of competitive, unfortunately that program has been reduced somewhat. And there's a lot of activity from the local, production community to try to get the state to, refund that at a higher level so we can bring in more productions and put more people to work in Texas.
Yeah, because it's sort of moved to Georgia now, huh?
Well, there's a lot of work in Georgia. For a while, there was a lot of work in Florida, but Florida actually ended their incentive program altogether, which basically killed the business there. So there's a whole complex fabric of, you know, how productions nowadays choose to shoot on location that didn't exist back then. And so, you know, I do, today I do what I'm called upon to audition for, and I take what I'm getting. I actually spend most of my time, you asked me if I ever completed grad school.
Right.
Well, the answer is yes. As a matter of fact, last year I got a master's in psychology, and I have three book contracts. So I'm spending a lot of my time writing books for actors about meditation practice and psychology.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Interesting. Is it true that you also run an art gallery that I thought I read?
I did have an art gallery for about 5 years. It's now closed, and I've sort of taken up the writing really full time at this point. But I was approached by a scientist, and this guy worked in nanotechnology, which is really basically manipulating matter at the molecular level. And he had run across an artist that did pointillist paintings. And pointillist paintings is literally paintings done with little tiny dots of oil paint, all carefully packed together to create an image. And this was a style that literally was started in the 1860s, I think, by a guy named Georges Seurat.
Mm-hmm.
And this scientist had come across an artist that was doing this by hand, but he had to quit because his body was wearing out. It's very hard to place hundreds of thousands of dots of teeny dots of paint. So this scientist, who spent his days placing molecules in discrete locations on silicone wafers, said to this artist, "I bet I can figure out how to make a robot that can place your paint dots for you." And so they had created this technology, but it had kind of stalled out. And so they approached me as sort of a businessman and an artist, because I had a background in art as well. And they said, "Could you help us with this?" So as a result of that, I ended up with three U.S. patents on this technology and a giant robot that's 11 feet by 15 feet long, weighs about 3,000 pounds, and a software platform that we have patents on that basically allows an artist to create massive paintings with hundreds of thousands of tiny dots of paint that are really quite unique. They're about the only pointillist artwork that still exists today because of the scale of the things.
Wow.
And that was, kind of wild, because I was able to actually make paintings like none other literally in existence. And eventually opened a gallery of my own and sold these paintings for a number of years. So,
if I understand this correctly, you began your career by being destroyed by a robot, and then that evolved into you creating a robot that creates.
That's exactly correct. And I actually have a book I'm working on called IQ versus AI, which will explore this new coming wave of artificial intelligence and robotics that are supposed to, you know, capture everybody's jobs. And I'm presenting a psychological model for well-being in the post-work age.
Wow.
So it's sort of, it's coming yet full circle again, because I'm dealing with robotics and artificial intelligence and how to be happy instead of splattered on a table.
Well, Kevin, I want to close this out with one last question and just have you tell me a little bit about your role on Seinfeld, your recurring role of Stu Chermak, the NBC chairman to whom Jerry pitches his, quote, show about nothing.
Absolutely. So I was living in Los Angeles, and I had met a casting director actually in Texas before I moved to L.A., who I think was a fan of RoboCop, ironically. And so he had come to know me, and he called me in on several auditions, and he called me in for this new show called Seinfeld, and I didn't know anything about it at the time. And I didn't get the part. It was a part, kind of a small part of a, I think it was a detective or something, but I read for Jerry and you know, the producers. And apparently they liked me. So about a year later, I get called in again for the same show, and they called me in for this part of this NBC executive, and I got the part, and so I ended up being the guy that invites Jerry Seinfeld to pitch his show about nothing to NBC. Now, the two things that are interesting about that are that that role was actually based on Rick Ludwin, who at the time was the head of NBC's late night and specialty programming. So I believe he was responsible for the late night talk shows as well as specials, etc. And in real life, he had been this young executive managing things like David Letterman, and he decided he wanted to, basically that's a historically reasonably accurate portrayal of what really happened.
Oh, wow.
And so I thought, wow, what a talented guy I am. You know, I did this show for basically for a year because the character kept recurring. And then on at the wrap party, at the end of that first season that Stu Chermak appears, Rick Ludwin shows up and we take a picture together and I meet him and he's sort of laughing because I was playing him. And I look at this guy eye to eye, because we're exactly the same height, and I look at his hair, which looks an awfully lot like my own, and I realize that they have me in these round metal glasses, which is what this guy wears, and I finally occurred to me after a year that perhaps the reason I got hired was that we looked eerily alike more than my incredible comic timing.
Hey, it could have been both. So, one doesn't disprove the other.
Yeah, that's probably true. So the cool thing about it was 4 or 5 years after I had that kind of arc on the show, I'd gotten married and moved back to Dallas where I make my home now, and actually had taken a hiatus from acting and was working as a stockbroker. And this is sort of how I got into the investment banking business ultimately. And I get a call from my agent, who still knew how to get a hold of me, and they said they want to bring you back for the final episode of Seinfeld. They've written in the Chermak character to this. And ironically, I had to go to my boss at the time at this stock brokerage who'd never seen Seinfeld and was not a particularly humorous fellow.
This is like grad school all over again.
I had to once again ask for permission to get a couple of days off from work to go be in a film project, and they literally spent a couple of weeks deciding, and they had to go talk to some people in their compliance department as to whether this was okay, and they were maybe going to say no, but they finally said yes, and so I was able to fly out and be on the now historic final episode of that show as well. So it was all worked out well in the end.
That's good. I'm glad to hear it. Where can people find you now? You have a Facebook page, right?
Yeah, I have a website, www.kevinpage.com. I also have blogs for my various book projects. So there's a www.actforactors.com, which stands for Advanced Consciousness Training for Actors, and that book will be coming out in September of next year. And I also do a blog called Mind Body Fitness, which sort of basically deals with things like meditation and exercise as ways to wellness, health, and happiness. So, wow. Kind of my gig now.
That's great. Kevin, thank you so much for talking to me today. This was wonderful to catch up with my squib hero.
Oh, thanks for having me, Matt. I appreciate it. Best of luck to you.
You too.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.